For the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about science and religion. Some of history's most important scientists were religious. Isaac Newton, for example, was almost a minister before he found science and went on to revolutionize it. Scientific investigation, he hoped, would enhance his understanding of God. Can science strengthen religious understanding, or will trying to reconcile science and religion weaken them both? This question figures into lots of places these days, from where political leaders seek guidance on environmental issues to what students learn in biology class. So take these two examples, for instance. This week, a Georgia school board challenged a judge ruling that it must remove stickers in textbooks that called evolution, quote, a theory, not a fact. The judge deemed the stickers an endorsement of religion. President Bush, who says his faith informs his policies, is not convinced of the authenticity of evolution. He said that he believes the verdict is still out. Is science fundamentally at odds with religion, or could they be complementary, perhaps providing answers to slightly different questions? Today, that question seems to be the same as it was in Newton's day, or possibly in Galileo's day. How should religion and science coexist? That's what we're going to be talking about this hour, and we certainly invite your questions. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guest. John Haught is a professor of theology and director of the Georgetown Center for the Study of Science and Religion at Georgetown University in Washington. He joins us today from Northern Virginia. Welcome to the program, Dr.
Thank
Haught.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Holmes Ralston III is a university distinguished professor in the Department of Philosophy at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. He joins us from member station KUNC in Greeley, Colorado. Welcome to the program, Dr. Ralston.
Nice to be here. Fine day in the Rocky Mountains.
Oh, that's good. Professor V.V. Raman is a professor of emeritus of physics and humanities at the Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Steven Weinberg is a professor in the Department of Physics, University of Texas at Austin, winner of the 1979 Nobel Prize in Physics. He joins us from member station KUT in Austin. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Weinberg.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Hi, how are you? Let's go to the big questions. How much? Let me ask each one of you first. How much of your personal belief systems were shaped by religion and how much by your scientific careers? Holmes Ralston, what about you first?
Well, I'm a son of a Presbyterian minister in the Valley of Virginia, so kind of from the cradle onward, and if you like, I was shaped to some extent by religious beliefs. Then I studied science along the way, and so my scientific studies, I think, modified and changed my religious beliefs, but nevertheless, religious beliefs continue.
John Haught?
Yes, I grew up as a Roman Catholic in Virginia, also in the countryside. And I also came from a family of scientists, and so I've always had a love of both science and theology. And as a Catholic, I've never had any problem reconciling the two.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Robin?
I have a slightly different view in that I come from the Hindu tradition, where religion means something very different, because it is not based on our beliefs, but on our experiences. The idea being that there is something beyond the physical world which we experience in different ways. So I have always been introduced into this mystical dimension, as it were, or the spiritual dimension, more exactly. And my love of physics has been there since my high school days, and so I'm as much a physicist as one devoted to the other dimension of human life, namely the spiritual.
Dr. Weinberg.
I grew up without religion, and as I've gotten older, I've become more and more inclined to dislike the influence of religion in the world and to hope that the human species will eventually outgrow it. That didn't have much to do with my going into physics. I'm in physics because I love physics. But I do hope that the advance of science in general and physics in particular will, in the long run, continue, as it has in the past, to weaken the hold of religion on people's minds.
Yeah, as you say, quoting from stuff that you have written, I'm all in favor of a dialogue between science and religion, but not a constructive dialogue.
That's right. I should say that there is no conflict between science and religion on the level where religion is simply a matter of ethnic identification or habitual practice or aesthetic enjoyment. But when it comes to belief in things being true or not true, as, for example, that there is something beyond the physical universe, that there is an afterlife, that there is a deity, it's on the level of belief that science and religion come into conflict. That's not all of religion by any means, but it is an important part. And in that respect, I think the advance of science has led to a general retreat of religion from areas in which it used to make very definite statements of belief. Not a retreat on all parts. I mean, there are still idiots out there in the world who think the world was created 6,000 years ago and that all the species were created at the same time. But leaving that minority aside, I think there has been a general retreat of religion in the area of belief. And I think that's a good thing.
Okay.
And I hope it will continue.
All right, we're going to get other views, your opinions, after we take this short break talking about the interface of science and religion. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about science and religion with my guest, Holmes Ralston III at the Department of Philosophy at Colorado State University, V.V. Rahman, professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, Steven Weinberg, University of Texas at Austin, John Haught at Georgetown University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me ask you, John Haught, pretty stern words from Steven Weinberg there about...
If religion were in the business of trying to give out scientific information, then surely it's going to compete with science, and there could only be a retreat if that was the function of religion. I don't think that is the purpose of religion, and in many ways the coming of science has delivered religion from the moonlighting job of trying to provide anything similar to scientific information. Religion is in the business of doing something quite, quite different. And as such, therefore, there can be no conflict.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us when you mean it's in the business of doing something quite, quite different. Doesn't it answer?
There are different ways of understanding religion. In a very broad sense, you could say religion is belief in something of ultimate importance. And even the scientist has religion in that sense. Or in a more narrow sense, you could say religion is belief that there's some sort of incomprehensible mystery that surrounds the universe. Einstein himself accepted religion in that sense of the term. Where I think the rubber hits the road and things really get sticky, and I think Steven Weinberg would probably agree with this, is where religion is understood as belief in what Steven calls an interested God or a personal God. And in I think what religion is attempting to do in using the symbol of a personal God is to get across the belief or the conviction that the universe ultimately is undergirded by a principle of care, by a principle of intelligence, by a principle of meaning. And so science doesn't do anything like that. Science is in the business of gathering much more limited kind of information. And as such, I don't think it can conflict with religion as I've understood it.
So you're not bothered by the fact that science would try to find, for example, in cosmology, a reason not to have a Big Bang at the beginning, so you avoid the problem of what put the Big Bang there?
Well, the doctrine of creation in no way depends upon the validity of the Big Bang theory, even though we probably would see that there's a kind of perhaps consonance or harmoniousness between Big Bang cosmology and the doctrine of creation. But the doctrine of creation is trying to get across the point that the universe is grounded in an ultimate reality, that the universe is a gift from something other than nature itself, that it's trying to answer the question, why is there anything at all rather than nothing, rather than trying to give us information, scientific information, about how the universe came into being.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rahman, are there some things beyond the scope of scientific inquiry about religion?
I believe there are many, many things in human life which transcend the explanatory levels of life. And religion is precisely dealing with those other aspects which have little to do with explaining natural phenomena. It seems to me that the two kinds of truths, religious and scientific, belong to entirely two different categories, ontologically speaking. One, religious truths are grounded, anchored to geographical, historical, and cultural roots, which are enormously important, whereas scientific truths transcend these and are, by definition, space and time invariant and culture invariant. And that is why efforts to bring the two together often fail. But once we realize that other kinds of truths beyond the space-time invariant truths are significant for a meaningful and interesting and enriching life, we begin to see that religion has much to contribute, especially of the enlightened variety. And that is why we have religions which have been playing an important role for generations and have important impacts on millions of people. And therefore, from my perspective, scientists who experience very often the same kinds of things that religious people do in terms of their awe and wonder should at the same time perhaps recognize the longings of other people. And it is by that kind of an understanding that we can build a civilization which has all the important benefits of science as well as of religion.
Holmes Ralston, can science ever answer the question of why we're here? The why question.
The scientific guidance of life is not possible. We spoke of retreat. Religion reforms, but I think the basic value questions are sharp and as painful as they've ever been after 400 years of science. So in figuring out what and how we ought to do in terms of love, justice, righteousness, those questions are urgent and haven't retreated at all. Likewise, it seems to me that the world that science has given us, the universe that science has given us, still raises religious questions. It's a wonderland kind of world that we live in, mysterious. In that sense, I don't think the religious questions have retreated at all.
1-800-989-8255. Elaine in DeWitt, New York. Hi, Elaine.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I just want to, I guess, affirm what one has already said. I'm a product of 12 years of Catholic school, 4 years of Catholic college, and I have always been strongly taught that there is no conflict between true science and true religion. I understand God to be the nature of nature, and one can go through the arguments, which clearly are not proofs, but are, I think, some arguments for an uncaused cause, an uncontingent being, something that got this whole process started. But that is not antithetical to the nature of God intending evolution. And the other bit is, I mean, we do attend church regularly and reverence scripture, but we do not see it as a history book nor as a science textbook, and try to see it as a faith-filled search and communication of the longings of human beings.
Mm-hmm. May I reply?
Yes, Stephen, go ahead.
I think what we're hearing from the caller who just called in and also from the other participants in this program is a very enlightened view of religion. It's one which I would argue does represent a retreat in the sense that if these opinions had been expressed about the fact that religion does not compete with science in a description of the world around us, the physical world, these are people who would have been burned in the Middle Ages and might today have quite a lot of trouble in many Islamic countries. But even for the enlightened view of religion that's being expressed here on this program, I would say there still is perhaps not a conflict but a tension, as Susan Hack, the philosopher, calls it, between science and religion on two levels. It's certainly true that science is never going to disprove the existence of an interested God or an afterlife, but when you learn the way the world works, as you learn more and more about the laws of nature and their chilling impersonal quality, as you learn more and more about the irrelevance of human life to the general mechanism of the universe.
Like the tsunami, for example.
Like the tsunami, for example. Mm-hmm. The idea of an interested God, of a path that has been laid out for human beings, of a cosmic drama in which human beings are playing a starring role, becomes increasingly implausible. Not disproved, but just implausible. But there's even a deeper level on which there's a conflict or a tension between science and religion, and that is that science demonstrates a mode of knowing which, as has been said, is culture-free, does not look back to sacred texts. No one today, in trying to settle an argument about general relativity, would quote Einstein as an authority, because we progress. He's a hero of ours, but he's not a prophet. He's not someone whose sacred writings we have to take seriously. This is rather different from the world's religions, even on the elevated, and I would say rather exceptionally enlightened level that's being expressed on this program. The tension is there, and I think it will continue to weaken the influence of religion, even though certainly I would never argue that science is all we need. Yes, there's a lot more to life than science. There's a lot of things science can never give us. But I just hope that the people will grow up and stop looking for the other things that science can't give them in the supernatural.
Yeah, may I?
Let me go to Professor Rahman first, because he jumped in first, then to you. Go ahead.
I just want to say I completely concur with what Professor Weinberg has just stated, and add that from the Hindu perspective, for example, and also from other religious perspectives, religion is more an experiential mode pertaining to aspects of the universe that are not directly accessible or not directly perceived in our everyday life. And therefore, there is much poetry and aesthetic value as well as a deeper experiential value that the religious mode gives. And therein lies the importance and value of religions, not in explaining natural phenomena.
Go ahead. Somebody wanted to jump in?
Oh, yes. I was going to say that tensions as well as conflicts can exist, logically speaking, only if both science and religion are trying to do the same thing, and therefore in a competitive relationship with each other. But I think especially since the 17th century, theology and religion have increasingly recognized that the objective of religion is quite distinct. The kind of cognition, the kind of knowledge that it's looking for is quite distinct from that of science. Galileo himself was very sophisticated in recognizing that we should not look to the Bible, for example, for scientific information. He was way ahead of
the... And look what happened to him.
At the time. So, and also, science decided at the beginning of the modern age that it's not going to talk about values, it's not going to talk about meaning, purpose, God, even subjectivity. It's going to leave all those things out. So methodologically, after leaving those things out, that means that it can't really come into conflict with a kind of discourse which brings them back in, unless a person insists that science is the only or the most authoritative way to truth. That's where the conflict arises, not between science and religion, but between scientism, which is a kind of faith system itself, and religion.
Well, let's not be too quick. We don't want to whitewash religion. There's a lot in religion we don't like.
I'm not trying to whitewash it.
Religions, people have constantly been self-critical and reflective and had to say there's better and worse sorts of religion. Furthermore, I do think there can be conflict between religion and science when you learn what causes earthquakes, plate tectonics, and so forth. You're no longer inclined to think the earthquake might be the wrath of God, as perhaps people did believe in ancient times.
We're talking about science and religion this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. But let me ask you, Dr. Ralston, what about our political leaders who, especially President Bush, who are have a great faith in their faith and use it as a means of setting public policy? Is that a legitimate use, do you think, for religion?
Well, I'm not a great admirer of present public policy, though I do respect Bush and the integrity of his faith. Yes, it is legitimate for a person's larger comprehensive worldview to enter into public policy, but it needs to be done in the pluralism of the democratic debate in that sense. So I'm going to back off from condemning the connection between President Bush and the war in Iraq. That's more complex than
well,
I want to deal with
right I'm actually now. Speaking about stem cell research, about the views on evolution, things like that. Forget the war for the moment, if you can.
Yeah.
The environment,
well,
you know.
Yeah. Yes, then your views about the sacredness of life will have something to do with what you tolerate by way of destruction of endangered species or by way of what you tolerate with regard to abortion of children, perhaps with defects and so forth. They do. They must. They should.
It seems to me the word that was introduced by Professor Ralston, namely sacredness, is extremely important in our interactions with one another and with the world at large. And religions somehow have really been the root of this notion of sacredness, which for many can be there without clinging on to traditional religions. But the fact remains that religion does endow us with this sensitivity for sacredness. And what President Bush or anybody else does on the basis of faith is not as important as what they do. It is not what we believe in, but what we do with our beliefs.
And in that vein, you all make reasonably sounding arguments, but there are other strident points of view out there, perhaps more in the minority, who may not care about the environment because they believe that the judgment day is right around the corner, the world's going to be destroyed at Armageddon, so why save it, you know?
Yes, I would say that what the people on this program, although we don't agree with each other, represent even collectively altogether a very minority view. That when you look at religion in the world, religion as a source of people killing each other, religion as a kind of superstition, it's much more common than the philosophically enlightened views that we hear on this broadcast.
I give about 30 seconds for a response. Would you agree with that?
In an unfinished universe, religions are unfinished and imperfect too, and I completely agree that in as Whitehead says, the religion came into the world mixed with all sorts of barbarisms and so forth and so on. But at the same time, I think it's possible to distinguish in religion and in science between what is pseudoscience and also pseudo-religion. We all strive to come up with some sort of normative or ideal understanding of religion, and most of us realize that religion in the concrete does not always live up to those ideals.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick break. Come back and take more of your questions, lots of them. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Microsoft. Your potential inspires us to create software that helps you reach it. Microsoft, your potential, our passion. From the Dibner Fund, encouraging the understanding of science and technology in our lives. From National Academies Press, offering full online access to more than 3,000 books on science, medicine, and engineering, at nap.edu. And from the National Science Foundation, America's investment in the future. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
How do different religious traditions view genetic engineering, cloning, or stem cell research? How do centuries-old religions adapt to new discoveries? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on the next Science Friday for a look at the intersection of religion, biology, and medicine, plus what the Huygens probe is revealing about Saturn's moon Titan. That's on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the intersection of religion and the physical sciences with my guests, Vivi Raman, who is the Rochester Institute of Technology professor, Steven Weinberg, University of Texas at Austin, John Hoyt, Georgetown University in Washington, and Holmes Ralston III, Colorado State University in Fort Collins. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can go to the phones, get some callers in. Jill in St. Louis. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. What I wanted to say is the question as presented, Ira, is already biased against the truth of religion, particularly creation. It assumes that science is already or can in the future disprove religion, and I don't believe that to be true. And I would also like to add that I came to believe in Christianity in particular, not by blind faith, but by logic. Logic also brought me to believe in intelligent design.
Do you think that science is out to disprove religion?
No, not in general. Evolution certainly is, certainly, but I don't think that any other area.
Why would science have to disprove religion?
They certainly wouldn't have to, but I think there are a lot of people out there who would like to disprove it so that they wouldn't have any kind of accountability, such as you can do anything you want to here on Earth because there is no God.
Steven Weinberg?
I think now we're hearing from the real spirit of religion.
Are you out to disprove religion?
I can't disprove the existence of God. I can certainly disprove the fact that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. I don't do it because I'm out to have any impact on religion. That's just the way the world is. And if this caller has convinced herself by logic in the necessity of intelligent design, then I think she really should go back over her arguments more carefully.
Mm-hmm. John, let me get another opinion. John Hoyt?
Well, religion is not primarily a matter of logic. Religion is a matter of trust, trust in something that you consider to be of ultimate concern to you. Now, it might be helpful if rationality and logic can show that religion is consonant with what we can find out through reason and science. But I, for one, do not want to base my religion, my sense of God, my sense of ultimate reality or ultimate values on what science tells me. However, I do want to make what I believe in completely consonant with science, and I want to learn from science something about ultimate reality. If I believe that this universe is created by God, then my study of the universe can tell me something about the Creator. Mm-hmm. And I would say that for me personally, evolution is not at all contrary to that, but evolution has disclosed a God who is luxuriantly creative, adventurous, and interesting, at least to me.
Jill, do you take the same? Is it just evolution that's most troubling to you about science or other areas also?
Just evolution.
Because that strikes you most at home in your faith.
Yes.
I find it really very offensive to be told that if there is no God, then we can have no moral principles. I don't believe in God, and I think I live quite a moral life. I think, in fact, our view of what moral principles are taught by religion have been evolving through the change in morality in society. I mean, it used to be thought that there was no conflict between Christianity and the existence of slavery. Today, many people think there is I think the evolution has not been an evolution of religion, but an evolution of the general morality of society. And I certainly don't like to be told that because I don't believe in God, that I therefore must be an immoral person.
That's not at all.
I didn't hear anybody say that, actually.
I am inclined to think that views to the effect that evolution is somehow offensive to religious beliefs and the like reflect the fact that we need in this society and elsewhere in the world to give more sound science education as well as more enlightened religious education.
Thanks for calling, Jill.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. Tell us a little bit more about the Hindu view about all of this.
Well, as I said, in the Hindu view, the question of God is not an entity to be proved on a quad erat demonstrandum basis, but an experience somewhat like music. And therefore, when we talk of spirituality, that represents a certain dimension of life which is different from the logical, analytical, explanatory mode. The Hindu thesis is that there are two kinds of reality, if you will. One that we appreciate, comprehend through the logical, analytical, scientific mode, and another that is experienced, and its highest expression is to be found in our proclivity for compassion and caring and love and joy and ecstasy. And those kinds of experiences transcend, as it were, the logical explanatory mode. And whatever one does as spiritual exercises, whether it is in prayer or chanting or in music, these things add, they enrich life's experience. And therefore, as Einstein would have said, but in a slightly different way, religion without science is emotion in the best sense of the term, without reason and analysis, and science without religion would be analysis without those experiential and emotional dimensions in a positive sense.
I think what we're hearing is a very elevated view of Hinduism, which has little to do with the way it's been practiced historically, and probably little to do with the way many adherents of Hinduism practice it today. Remember, Hinduism has supported and enforced a caste system over the centuries of a particularly vicious kind. And if you go back in history, I think many Hindus would be surprised to learn that Hinduism had nothing to say about the existence of gods or goddesses.
No, I just want to clarify that. First, regard the caste system and other things that would, of course, correspond to the existence of slavery in Christendom and the like. But more importantly,
which was also supported by religion.
Yes. So what I'm trying to say is the doctrinal basis of the Hindu worldview, which for sure, like the highest principles of Christianity, are not quite followed by the practitioners of the religion. That's not what I was trying to say. And I also feel very strongly that in this complex multicultural world in which we live, it is as important to learn about whatever is positive in other religious traditions as to be aware of their very many negative aspects. Just as when we talk about religion, we talk often about in the Christian world about persecutions and the Holocaust and the like, which unfortunately are historically true. But we need to focus on whatever positive things the various religious traditions have given to humankind.
1-800.
I think if you focus on the positive aspects, you're likely to get a very distorted picture.
1-800-989-8255. Tom in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing? First of all, thanks for taking my call. I'm a high school anthropology teacher, and at times it feels like initially when I started teaching this that I would have to teach this subject almost with padded gloves. But I've come to the realization my job is not to sway anyone's viewpoint in any way, shape, or form. What I'm intended to do with my teaching is to simply educate. And what I found when I get into the topic of adaptation, and that's what I refer it to because it seems to alleviate any emotions that come simply with the word of evolution, is I give them physical, tangible evidence that is fact. through Bergman's rule, Allen's rule, genetic drift, isolationism, things that can be seen, things that are tangible. And then I tell them simply, the mechanism is the only thing that is in question. Evolution slash adaptation is not a controversial topic when it's addressed with factual information. And that is through the fossil evidence. That is through the things that we learn through natural selection. It's the mechanism, and that's a personal decision. And I don't see it as a controversial topic. I see it as ignorance in many aspects.
So you skirt the issue sort of by saying that science has no superior mechanism for explaining it.
Not necessarily skirting it per se. Again, I don't think it's my role to say what the mechanism is behind it. My job is to educate, as far as I see it, is to educate what is out there.
So you'll explain natural selection, but there could be a hand behind it if the students want to accept it that way.
Exactly. It could be some supreme being, or it could be by complete happenstance. But the fact of the matter is, what is out there is not being taught to these children in the correct manner to educate them so they can have logical discussions with one another.
One of the ways you could approach this is through what you might call layered explanation. We tend, unfortunately, to be explanatory monists, to look for some simple explanation and then say, that's true, rather than another one. But in approaching something like evolution, you could take it just, for example, suppose there's a pot of water boiling on your stove, and somebody says, why is it boiling? At one level, you can say it's because molecules of water are moving around excitedly. At another level, you could say it's boiling because my wife turned the gas on. At another level, you might say it's boiling because I want tea. So you have three different levels of explanation. Now, when you look at evolution from a scientific point of view, you're looking at it through a method which has decided from the beginning to be somewhat impersonal. So just because the mechanism of evolution looks impersonal at the scientific level does not exclude the possibility logically that there are other things going on in evolution that are too deep for scientific explanation, for mathematical measurement to elicit, to bring out into the open. So logically speaking, it's possible that at one level, natural selection is the mechanism, but at another level, that doesn't logically rule out that there's something much deeper going on that's compatible with what religions are saying about the world.
You got an account in evolutionary history of this long genesis of things that are more biodiverse, more complex, and it's true, you get the description of that, but eventually you have to respond and react to the meaning and significance of that. And now I find my institution, Colorado State University, big natural resource school, the biologists celebrate this biodiversity. It's pretty easy to get religious reverence for nature and respect for nature. With a conservation biologist, we think of Earth as kind of a wonderland and what we ought to do about conserving the natural world. Then you're facing these kind of issues that do mix science and religion, I think often in complementary ways.
All right, Tom, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking about religion and science this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And, of course, I guess ultimately when you're talking about origins, kids are going to want to know, you know, take me back as far as you can go. You can talk about the pot boiling. You can talk about the rocks. They're going to want to know how they got there, you know.
They're going to want to know where they're going, too.
And where they're going. They're going to want to know, you know, what came before the rocks. And eventually they're going to you're saying, I hear you, they have to decide for themselves or – or do they need guidance in deciding, or where? What is the role of science in this?
Well, it seems to me that... Sorry.
Well, some of both. And, you know, science discovers some things, and that's the end of it. And it's cumulative. So we found out the world is round, and that's it. We found out photosynthesis is working in the woods, and, you know, we found out how to make a light bulb with Thomas Edison. Those things don't have to be rediscovered from generation to generation. But a lot of the religious elements of life, whether it's worthwhile to be courageous or loving or forgiving, you know, whether you ought to keep promises, whether you ought to steal or not steal, those things have to be relearned in each generation. In that sense, I think science and religion are different.
Dr. Raman, you wanted to jump in there?
Yes, I just wanted to say that thanks to the work of people like Professor Weinberg, we do have a fairly good understanding of how the world came to be, and we have a what science offers is consistent, coherent, and rational interpretations of the observed phenomenal world. But as to the question of why it happened, that certainly is what one would call a mystery, and for which we have no simple answers. And the answers that are given by the great religions may be called the doctrines or the dogmas of the religion. But the mystery itself is what the experience of that mystery is what one would call a spiritual experience. And we need to recognize that there comes a time in these probings where certain mysteries have to be just left that way, and that's part of being human.
I have 30 seconds, Dr. Weinberg. You'd say that you could find these things out.
No, I don't think that science can explain why the world exists or why it is the way it is. I think the success of our impersonal description of the world, a description in terms of impersonal laws, suggests to me, without proving it, that that question has no sense. But it doesn't prove that. The great thing that science has done that's relevant in this area is to show that impersonal explanations are possible. Many people, I'm thinking particularly at this moment of Cardinal Manning, said that he became convinced of the truth of religion because he could not conceive of any other way that living things could be brought into being with all their wonderful adaptation. Well, now we know how that is possible through impersonal laws and through accidents. And that's a wonderful thing.
All right, we've got to go. You made the point. We can't stretch the clock. We've run out of time. I want to thank you all for taking time to talk with me. Our producers for this hour, Annette Heiss, Charles Berquist, Abby Leonard, senior producer Karen Berghoff. Charles Berquist is also our director, and our interns are Corey Binns and Todd Neal. I'd like to thank all my guests, Steven Weinberg, 1979 Nobel laureate in physics, professor of physics, University of Texas at Austin, John Haught, professor of theology, director of Georgetown Center for the Study of Science and Religion at Georgetown University, Holmes Ralston III, university distinguished professor in the Department of Philosophy at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and V.V. Raman, professor of emeritus of physics and humanities at Rochester University, Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
If you missed any of this, thank you. If
you
missed any of what we talked about, one other link, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can also email us there, and we will take this program and make a teaching curricula, free teaching curricula, at Science Friday's Kids Connection on our website. You can download it and take it into your classrooms. Just press on the teacher's button. Also, you can download back editions of Science Friday on your iPod or listen to them on Real Audio. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.